JesusRising.com.
We're in Jerusalem. We're actually across the street from where I usually interview Yitzhak Chayutman, the corner of Azza Street and Metudela. Today I'm going to speak with a fellow named Frank Romano, American, who lives and works in France, teaches law in a French university. He's a lawyer who had a very interesting experience some time ago and wrote a book about it. And there are a number of subjects that I hope we can listen to and learn from. Frank, why don't you tell us a little bit about what your book is about, and we'll go from there.
The book is about a spiritual path that I followed in 1977 from Paris, and my vision was to come to Israel and Palestine and work on the peace process, work with people while I'm learning more and more. And so I left Paris after having this kind of vision, sort of after a meditation session, and got down to Casablanca. And my idea was to travel across North Africa and arrive in Israel and Palestine and share what I learned and continue learning. I was invited to learn about Islam in this mosque while I was sleeping on the streets there. This person wearing a pearl-white jalebba, and he looked like he just descended from heaven. And so I entered the mosque because this was something I wanted to do, learn about Islam and learn some Arabic. And after a week of doing that, the door I had freely entered through just a week before was now shut, and there was a guard in front, and you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out I was in prison. And that's when the drama sort of began. There was brainwashing, for sure. There was good cop, bad cop type of approaches to get me to convert to what I found later was an extremist version, extreme version of Islam. I was explained to later, years later, by an expert that this was a Salafi group or Wahhabist group that had implanted in Casablanca. They are Sunnites, but was in the beginning of the Back to Islam movement in Morocco that has since apparently blossomed. And so I didn't have my antenna up at the time, expecting in 1977-78 that there was such a group that exists. So I had no clue until it was a bit late. I was in the mosque, and they never ever articulated this to me, but I think their goal was to convert me to this extreme version of Islam, and then I would send me back to Paris and eventually to the U.S. to help recruit for them. They never articulated that, but I figured that must have been what they were doing with me, except I wasn't converting as quickly as they wanted me to. So after a week and a half, apparently the assistant imam in charge of my conversion developed a theory to justify why I wasn't converting. And that was, I must not have been there to learn about Islam, but I was planted there on the one hand to interfere with their Back to Islam movement. On the other hand, therefore, I must be a Zionist spy. And without getting involved in the definition of the word Zionist, of course they were using the distorted version of what Zionist is, in a derogatory sense. And so he filed an official claim before the imam that this is what was happening. Two official charges, and they put me on trial within the mosque. And they excluded me in the madrasa. So it was a 5-day period. All of a sudden I'd been taken out of the mosque where I had been living for a week, sleeping in the loft where women come to pray that no longer are allowed into the mosque. Here we are, 5 or 6 people. I'm the only involuntary person studying in this mosque. And they called us like Islamic monks. They were all Moroccans there voluntarily except me. And all of a sudden now I'm being rooted out into the madrasa, into the school, which was empty because they were out on vacation and keeping me there, feeding me and bringing me water and not talking to me for 5 days, except they brought me into the mosque once before the imam and the assistant imam, who was apparently the prosecutor, and before a couple of the monks who were trying to defend me to articulate what the charges were. And then they took me right back into the madrasa where they kept me until 5 days later, two or three of the what I consider Islamic monks came out and informed me that I had been acquitted of the charges, which was a relief. And then they brought me back into the mosque like nothing had happened. So now I'm eating and laughing with my fellow monks and the imam like nothing happened. They were telling stories, and I slept with them again in the loft, and we'd pray five times a day. And the next morning I get up after morning session of prayer session about 6, well, I get up after the session at 6:30 and find out that the door is still shut and I'm still not free to go. So at the moral of this adventure is not a criticism of Islam, because I did learn a lot from Islam. Is everyone has their own path. I don't have the monopoly on anyone's conscience embodiment of universal love or the universal path to God. Everyone has their own way. I needed to take this path. And I need to find answers to my question, and I did find some answers.
I'm very curious, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are, what is the great attraction of Islam to so many Westerners? It seems like there's a tremendous wave of people converting, Europeans, Americans. I told you I saw a TV thing with a woman from Texas, a blonde Texas woman converts to Islam and goes on the Hajj to Mecca. It was very striking. What in your experience is so compelling?
Well, I'll speak for me, and then I'll try to speak as objectively as possible for others. What was interesting for me was it was not just a religion in itself, or practicing the prayers and praying and so forth. It was really it became a way of life. Almost, and often, I think what really hooks people into Islam are promises of a better life. There are responses to all your questions. It's like all wrapped up in a package with a pretty bow on top. Except often, this way of life, including political organization, political structures, is often a misinterpretation of what I consider the authentic interpretation of the Quran. But that is this. There are different Qurans out there. Even extremists have their own version of the Quran and their own interpretation, which tells people, "This is the way. I'll show you the way. Join us, or you will burn in the fires. But we will save you," which justifies to them often to do all kinds of things to people to get them to convert.
That sounds to me very much like Catholicism, which you have experience of. Is it different? I mean, is there a difference between that and the Catholic way of bringing people into the community that you would know?
You know, fundamentally, I don't perceive a great difference in overall objective, nor do I see a huge difference in technique. Now, I was raised in an Episcopalian tradition, which are considered Anglican Catholics. My dad was a Catholic, and I did go to the Catholic Church a lot, especially with my children, with my former Mexican-American wife, and went to the Catholic Church all the time. And I find it's in the Catholic Church, there is also the great force of persuasion. The words often are the same, depending upon how much of an orthodox the priest is, that people conform to the rules or they will burn, or they're burned in the fires of hell. And it's based a lot on fear. And I see that essentially underlying a lot of the extremist Islamic groups. It's not based on spontaneous giving and taking a lot. It's based on if you don't do, I guess they also believe, of course, in charity, giving to poor people. That's one of the fundamental rules. If you don't, you will also go to hell, as opposed to freely giving from your heart. I find this is a common denominator among, let's say, Orthodox Catholics, or fervent Catholics, and extremist Muslims. I see that as a common denominator, and others.
I want to jump back a moment. You told me before about how you managed to leave Morocco. I thought that was an interesting story.
Now, do you want me to reveal how I figured out how? Because it's okay. Well, for those of you that would like to read the book Storm Over Morocco perhaps might want to turn down the volume. The key was I befriended the guard, and the guard there in Morocco, he told me, no, we spoke French. They spoke mainly French to me. Yes, this is in Casablanca when I'm inside the 10-foot wall compound of this extremist group. I befriended the guard. In other words, I'd walk around the garden outside the mosque, sometimes take walks in between prayers, and often alone, often in my thoughts, or sometimes I'd see one of the Islamic monks and talk to him, and we'd compare notes about the Quran. And then I'd talk with the guard, and the guard was very friendly. And the guard was very friendly, and because, mind you, the prayers were in, of course, Arabic, and I was learning Arabic a little bit, but most people address me still in French, as Morocco was once a French colony. Everyone still learns French, so we spoke in French. And the guard seemed open and had nothing else to do, and he was a nice guy. As time went on, I'd just take walks every day and meet the guard. I felt I was too weak to think about climbing over the wall. There were no places to do so, but if I were physically better off, I might have attempted it somewhere. But I had just finished Ramadan. I'd lost a lot of weight. It was very hot. And I'd been drinking the Moroccan water, which did not agree with me, so my intestines were in revolt. I had a constant cold because they were constantly pressuring me to stay inside the mosque, which is kind of dank, almost like an old castle. And then you go out, it's very hot. So this change in climate, you know, plagued me with this constant cold. So anyway, with befriending the guard, I felt that there's no way I'm going to be able to leave this place. And it became almost a dichotomy. My life became a living dichotomy. Here I am resisting to the brainwashing. Every time they talk about the Jews are evil, the Christians are evil, don't follow them. And yet, my best friends are Jewish. I was raised a Christian. That helped me resist. And the meditation I was doing secretly was helping me focus on God and getting strength. But they were starting to get to me, in spite of my strength and my spiritual resistance. So the dichotomy was this. As time went on, I was being broken down. Even though I felt spiritually I was moving forward, especially many of the secret things I was doing, along with the many things I was learning from Islam. And is there going to be a point when I actually accept this extremist version of Islam? So that's what motivated me most to leave, even though I didn't feel at this point I was in direct danger, unless I continued asking questions I had before. And they might suspect again that I was there to sabotage their movement, but I did become sort of a model Muslim at the time. No questions. I was very careful how I bathed before prayer and how I prayed. So here now I am. I figured out after these walks, talking with the guard, that if somehow I could get the guard to release me. And of course, I had to somehow do this surreptitiously. So one day, I learned from the guard that he was going to go on vacation. I said, well, I had some money, you know, I had some dirhams, which is the Moroccan money, and I gave him a few dirhams. Says, well, have a good time, and hopefully I'll see you soon. And he said, well, I'm not taking my vacation yet, and that was it. And so I saw him the next day, a few more dirhams. I didn't have much money on me, and my money was slowly slipping away, but I thought, well, maybe he will let me leave. And I would tell him that I would leave just for a few hours to see my friends in Casablanca. Of course, this would have been, I hate to lie, but under the circumstances, I did feel that I was in danger and still confused, that the best thing I could do was to leave this place. I just felt I have to leave. And sometimes I didn't even know why sometimes, and I felt I urged to leave. And so one day, it happened where, well, first of all, I went back, and the guard was no longer there. I thought, oh, my goodness, I pretty well spent all my money now. And the guard was gone, and there's a new guard there, and I've lost my last chance to leave. And I wasn't getting much stronger physically, so I couldn't even contemplate, you know, finding a way over the wall. So I thought, and I went back to the mosque totally depressed, knowing that I might be stuck there forever now. and soon they'll get to me, perhaps, and I will then become an extremist like them. And I was afraid of the blinders. And anyway, 3 days later, I took a walk around. I noticed the guard I had befriended had returned, and I tried not to be over anxious. And of course, our conversations could not be privy. The imam could not be privy to, because he would think I'm planning somehow to get out or whatever. And I knew that he would persecute me after that, and change his vision of me as the perfect Muslim now. And so, because they had that idea that I was a perfect Muslim, they controlled me less. And so I was free to walk around the compound, but I still wasn't free to go. So that time I saw the guard. I said, "Look, I've got more money, but maybe this is my last chance. Maybe I could give you a couple more dirhams." I gave him a couple more dirhams. That was really almost the last of my money, at least in my pocket change. And I said, "Look, can you just let me go for maybe 1 hour to see my friends? And I'll be back by afternoon prayer." This is in the morning, late morning. And he opened the door in front of me. And I got to the door and he slammed it in my face. And he said to me, "You think I'm crazy? I know what you're trying to do. All I have to do is advise the imam what you're doing and you'll be locked up. And I don't know what they're going to do with you." I said, look, I'm sorry. I'd like to leave to see my friends a bit, but I'm sincere about this." But he said, "You're joking. Step away from me." And I said, "Look, I tried my last shot here, because who knows, he might be gone tomorrow on vacation, I'd never see him, and by then I may be a lost cause." So I said, "Well, look, I tried the last thing was, I've got money in my backpack. You know, when you enter into this place, the other monks as well as me, they take all our belongings and put into a room. And I knew this room was right next to the gate, but locked. And I don't know who had the key, but I said, look, in that room next to you where you're sitting is my backpack, and there's money there." And he said, looked at me and said, kind of curious, I figured he's reading my mind. There's no way anything like this is going to happen. And I didn't even know what I was going to do once he started foraging around in my backpack. I said, well, there's got to be some way I can get over somehow, try something while he's not looking. And so he did. He said, "Well, I've got the key, and you stay right here. I'll be right back." And he goes to the door, he opens up the door, and I hear him unzipping stuff and looking. I couldn't tell him exactly where the money was, but I knew there was some money in there. And while he did that, I looked at the door, finding maybe there's a way I can climb, because the door will help me have a foothold as opposed to the wall where there was no foothold. And then noticed that there was a crack. And I noticed there was a crack of daylight there. And I said, that's never been before. Could it be that when he slammed the door so hard, it jolted open again and didn't automatically lock like it always does when the door closes? And I crept to the door. I kept hearing him still making noises, so he still hadn't found it, fortunately. And I pushed the door a bit and noticed it was open. So I slipped out. I pushed the door a little more, slipped out, and caught my jalaba. Couldn't get it uncaught. Finally got it uncaught. Kicked off my shoes. I wore these pointed Arabic shoes that were going to slow me down, and just started running.
And you ran to?
I ran and I ran. It was the outskirts of Casablanca. I ran through fields barefoot. I cut my feet.
Tell me about the people that you stayed with.
And I finally, you know, after going through alleys, it probably took me several hours until nighttime to break open into the streets. And I went back to the people that I had originally known, which are the Berber family there. And they opened the door, fortunately, and I literally fell unconscious for a while. And when I woke up, my feet had been bandaged, and they hid me until I could leave the country. Well, there was another 2 week period went by before I could leave the country. One reason was I had no money, and I had to wire home, and they helped me wire to my family to send me money so I can get back to Paris. And so I waited for the money to come. And on the other hand, was a strategy, because these people were everywhere, and they finally located. I don't know. I guess they found out through someone else who had known where I had been originally staying for a few days before I entered the mosque. And so they were coming to the door. And even though the mother who always answered the door said that I wasn't there, they kept coming back with messages that they'd love me and I should return, and I think I'd left my backpack. They have my things and my... So we had to be very careful, and so we derived a strategy. The following strategy is that I would buy a train ticket that would leave exactly during the time when they would all be in the mosque in morning prayer, because this was a very orthodox group, extremist group, but they were always there for prayer. There was just no excuse. So I knew that they would all be there, that unless they sent out spies or whatever, which I don't think they would, because they're bound to be at prayer, at least there'd be fewer people out watching the house, that we would leave even earlier, right in the beginning of prayer. And the train was scheduled to leave during prayer, fortunately. We found an early train. So we get to the train station, and it was kind of an eerie place because there were no people hanging out. I felt, God, it's strange. And there were, people in the corners, and it was dark and shadowy. And it was walking through the Anse in Medina to get there, through the alleys and through the slums. And it was just like a labyrinth before we got there, and like an eternity. And I got on the train. Finally got on the train and, flew away, but I never really felt secure until actually 2 years after that. I got to Paris, but I had this paranoia that stayed with me until about 2 or 3 years after I felt that it was tempered. It was diffused a bit, this strong feeling that I was being followed and that someday I would pay for having escaped. And the reason why was, while I was in the mosque, every once in a while, they would tell me, Muhammad Abdulaziz, which was the name they gave me, we are so happy that you've found the true path to God. But remember, you were a non-Muslim before you came here. And non-Muslims that convert, that reject the church, have committed a capital crime. They never explained to me what would happen, what the punishment would be. For having committed a capital crime, but I figured what it would be. And so this was always lurking in the back of my mind wherever I went. And of course, leaving Morocco, I was very concerned with, even all the way up to the Tangier. The train took me to Tangier, and I was on the boat. I was, before I even got on the boat, there were guards. There was the border control, immigration guards, and I felt, for sure, I'm not going to make it through that. That they had advised them to, and for somehow they'd find some way to apprehend me or accuse me of some crime, and I'd never get out. Even when I finally got on the boat and the boat started moving, I felt, well, this is a good sign, but I still didn't feel secure. And again, even getting into Paris, I didn't feel secure until years later.
To change the subject, yeah. Frank, you're here in Israel now working on a number of projects. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm privileged to have finally made it to Israel and Palestine almost 30 years after this event. And it happened in a very interesting way. I'm a professor at the University of Paris, and there's a wonderful lady who came to Paris to teach us, in a conference, to teach us about the Kabbalah and its link to Isaac Newton. And she's written a book about this. I've got to remember her name now.
I have a video of her.
Do you remember her?
Hebrew.
Yes. Yeah. And all of a sudden, after the conference, we find ourselves having lunch, sitting next to each other at a kosher lunch, and we're having this conversation about what is going on in Israel, all these different groups coming together for peace and understanding, the Muslims, Jews, and Christians, and other religions, that led me to believe. She left. I got her email, but she left, who led me to believe later that maybe it's time for me now to complete the circle, and that I had lived for many years in the Jewish community in Paris. Of course, I've lived with Muslim, raised as a Christian. Maybe it's time for me to share what I'd learned and come here to Israel. So I came. She connected me with a lot of people. And with the understanding that it's not sure that people are going to accept me, or even they will wonder where I came from, and why I'm interested in this. And she connected me with Muslims and Jews, and it just was like magic. It just clicked. And all of a sudden, I met people. I felt we were on the same path together. And since then, I've helped organize an interfaith group with Naomi Babad, member of the Rose of Galilee, and in this wonderful place, this wonderful kibbutz called Hukuk, in the Sea of Galilee, and every year I've come back to participate and help organize this event. It's a one-day event. But what I was disappointed, though, that many of the Palestinian friends could not come to this event, to the checkpoints, of course, and to the, you know, the evolution of things lately. It's been very difficult for people that have been able to come in the past to Jerusalem, to Israel, cannot come. So after the day event, I go to Ramallah to share with them what we'd done, what we'd learned. And this has been a very important part of my coming here. And finally, so that Palestinians would be more involved now, I'm organizing a peace march, a peace freedom march, October 6th, starting from Ramallah to Jerusalem, and another group from Jerusalem to Ramallah, to show the world that there are many people here that want peace and want understanding, and we love each other as brothers and sisters, in order to temper what the press often underlines is the violence and the Israeli retaliation to terrorist attack. Of course, you know, defensive retaliation, terrorist attacks, but it only looks like there's a lot of bloodshed being spilled here, and there are not many people interested in true peace, love, and understanding, which is contrary to the truth. There's much work here being done, and I'd like this group to coordinate many of these groups that aren't working together for various reasons, and to make peace something that could happen tomorrow as opposed to hundreds of years today. I think it's going to happen. There's much happening here for that to take place. We need to just organize this energy focusing on true understanding, this path to God that I feel here so powerful, and then hopefully soon that we can find a way to bring the peoples together to overcome some of the propaganda we're receiving on both sides, and so that we can have peace, which is definitely a doable thing.
Thank you very much, Frank. By the way, who's the publisher of your book, just to give you a little plug there?
Thank you. This is World Audience. It's a medium to small size publisher out of New York, which is also publishing a book of prose of mine. And the book Storm Over Morocco can be found on Amazon almost everywhere now. And it has my email in it, and also I have a website. It's www.frankromano363.com, and there explains a little bit about the book, and there's a guest book, so I'm most interested in having feedback from people, whether you read the book or not, or comments even about this interview. On my website you can find that email, which is frankfro, frankfro at AOL.com, and you can freely converse with me and communicate with me your ideas about this or anything else. I'm open to all comments, all suggestions, and I just thank you very much, Oram, for having me, and I wish you well and I bless you. Thank you.